The following program is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Welcome to Humanities Connection, a production of WFDU-FM and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. I'm Bob Mann. As usual, we have two very different but equally interesting segments on this episode of Humanities Connection. In just a few minutes, you'll hear my conversation with Julia Taylor. Julia is Director of Community Planning and Development for an organization in Trenton called Isles. We're going to be talking about an NJCH incubation grant for a new program called Touring Trenton. You may be surprised by the many historical and cultural points of interest that are located in the state capital. But first, a fascinating interview about a play called Life, Death, and Life Again. Radical forgiveness. It's a concept which is easy to understand, but very difficult, if not impossible, to demonstrate in real life. But radical forgiveness is one of the central themes of an acclaimed theater piece entitled Life, Death, and Life Again, Children Sentenced to Die in Prison. The New Jersey Council for the Humanities funded many important aspects of this theater production, and my guest on the program right now, he's on a phone, speaking to us for the next 14 minutes, Dan Swern, who is co-founder and producing director of CoLab Arts. Dan, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Bob, thank you so much for having me.
Let's first of all talk about the title, Life, Death, and Life Again, Children Sentenced to Die in Prison. Are we talking about the death penalty for minors or the de facto reality that if you're sentenced for life, it really is a death sentence?
When we talk about children being sentenced to die in prison, we're talking about extreme sentencing. The United States is the only country in the world that sentences children to life imprisonment. And we're talking about young people who are typically considered juveniles in our court system and who are tried as adults and then sentenced to life without parole.
Let's talk about the format of the play. So I've read in some of the research that I did for this conversation that it is a verbatim play. What does that mean? What exactly is the format that you're using to tell some of these stories of these kids and also of the victims and their families?
Bob, that's right. It's a verbatim theater piece, meaning that the words you hear on stage are directly taken from interviews with individuals who have experienced these real experiences themselves, either as incarcerated individuals or as families of victims. Our playwright, Elizabeth Weil Greenberg, is an incredible individual, spent a number of years as a case analyst for the Innocence Project, and has been working as the communications director for the New Jersey Institute for Social Justice. Took it upon herself for about 3 or 4 years to engage in a series of interviews with individuals who were incarcerated for murder as juveniles and sentenced to life without parole. She created the piece because she had seen similar work done through her time at the Innocence Project for individuals' stories who had been wrongfully convicted and incarcerated. And what she wanted to do was highlight individuals who themselves were guilty and acknowledged those charges, but to show that those aren't stories that should be ignored, that the individuals whom we do incarcerate for violent crime, for other potential offense, have just as many rights, experiences, and have specific conditions that push them into those actions, particularly as juveniles. We are talking about young people who are brought up under very vulnerable conditions, and those are the kinds of stories we want to be able to highlight to show that an individual who commits a violent crime is not a bad person, and their story is just as valuable.
Just to play devil's advocate here, though, you heard my intro, and maybe I'm not playing devil's advocate as much as I'm even expressing some of my own feelings. I said that radical forgiveness is a concept easy to understand, but difficult, if not impossible, to demonstrate in your own real life. I have to honestly say, and I think I'm reflecting the feelings, Dan, of many people in our tri-state area and internet audience, that you really have to consider the feelings of the victim's family, the suffering of the victim. Is there any way in which our showing mercy and some sense of restorative justice to the offender that we're ignoring the pain of the victims and their families?
You're absolutely right in terms of needing to consider the feelings, the emotions, the pain of the families of victims and victims themselves when it applies. What we're pushing forward with this story and with this production is the idea that life sentencing without parole is systemically counter our general value statements around how we should be looking at our justice system. Do we want to create a punitive justice system where people are removed, put away, and we turn the light out on them? Or do we want to look at a restorative justice system where people who commit a crime, however terrible it might be in the moment, and look at the conditions that push them into those instances, and look at how we can potentially bring them back in a healing capacity to be productive, to be instrumental members of society, and on the other side, help create a healing component for the families of those families of the victims themselves as well. And where we talk about this being radical forgiveness, that's absolutely hard to accept potentially, and we're asking a very hard question of everyone involved in the justice system as well as the public. Can we potentially look at a way of conducting justice that is restorative?
Let's give an actual solid example. We've been talking in theory. Let's hope no one in the audience ever, you know, has a loved one taken away or is the victim of violence. But you have here a verbatim play. There have to be real stories. I don't want to have any spoilers here, but in which there is a story of someone who did actually find the strength to engage in this radical forgiveness. Can you share at least one of those from your play, from the theater piece, with the audience?
That's right. There's an interview with an individual named Bill, and he gives us his story. He was the grandson of a woman who had been murdered by a young girl and her friends. They came into her home under false pretenses. They were 14-year-old girls, and they attempted to rob her and stabbed her, I think, about 30 times. And they left her to die in her dining room. And Bill's story is very much what we've been talking about, that he came from a very angry, very pained place in terms of thinking about and narrating for the audience what his experience was like at trial. And then the moment he saw that this was a 14-year-old girl and realized that, oh my God, I understand her conditions. I understand that this is not something that that happens just because a person is bad, but because the world around them is not supportive of them. It's not nurturing. And also Bill turned to God and wanted to know whether or not God would support the idea of killing a young person, whether it be by the death penalty or just through long-term imprisonment. And he came to the conclusion for himself, and we share this in a story, that he ultimately wanted to make sure that the justice system at large started to think more restoratively for people like the young girl that killed his grandmother. That, yes, his grandmother was a victim. He was a victim, but he wanted to look beyond his pain and try and make sure that the next person doesn't experience the world and doesn't experience these terrible conditions in the same way that he did.
Let's talk a little bit about the role of our underwriter, the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. They were one of your funders. What was their role, and what have they actually been able to contribute? Because, as we've mentioned so many times on this broadcast, there are plays, there are theater pieces, there are performances, and then there's the humanities aspect of it, where there's either a discussion or a learning opportunity or something instructional. So give us some background on the involvement of the council and some of these related projects that go along with the theater piece itself.
Absolutely. Collab Arts generally really looks to see how art can be impactful and play a role generally in our community and in the lives of the people that live in the New Brunswick, Middlesex County area here in New Jersey. And so we look to continue conversations from stage to the home, from stage to the neighborhood. And the New Jersey Council for the Humanities became really instrumental for this piece in trying to connect the play, the interview work that Elizabeth was already doing, in connecting that to policy and conversation. And through the grant, we were able to engage the support of the Sentencing Project and probably one of the country's leading experts on life sentencing without parole for juveniles, Josh Rovner. And we put together a panel discussion that included leading experts in both radical forgiveness as well as sentencing policies for juveniles for the two performances that we were able to present in New Brunswick. And that's actually been a component we're now integrating into all of our performances. And the idea of that humanities integration has only grown, where our audiences are now not only community members for those for whom these stories reverberate and have value, but we're also now using the piece for continuing education. We're working with the Philadelphia Defenders Association for a new performance that's coming in September, on September 25th. To provide CLE credits, that's a continuing legal education credits for attorneys. And we're doing something similar on December 11th at Luna Stage in West Orange with the New Jersey State Bar Association. And then we have another performance on December 5th at Monmouth University. And the university is providing continuing education for social workers. So the work is not only emotional and impactful and serves as a great piece of storytelling, but we're finding ways that it can actually support development and real social improvement and development professionally and for our communities.
The dates that you gave, I appreciate that you gave them for our initial broadcast on WFDU-FM, September 25th, will already have come and gone. But those next two performances would be right in our listening area, and people can certainly get information about those performances, which are going to be happening in October and in December. So let's talk even beyond these upcoming performances. Actually, before we wrap it up with a final thought, let's be pragmatic here. How can people find out about getting tickets? Because these sell out very quickly, these performances. How can they get tickets or information about tickets for October 25th and the December event?
The best thing to do is to sign up for our mailing list. And what we're going to let our mailing list know immediately when tickets become available. We've been really excited about all of the energy and enthusiasm around these performances, and they typically sell out in a week and a half or so wherever we go. And we've also been really lucky to have an incredible coalition of nonprofits and donors that have been able to help us underwrite these performances and keep them free for the public, as well as really amplifying the word whenever we go to a new community.
And again, where specifically can they be looking? Where should they go?
Sure. Our website is www.colab-arts.org. And on Facebook, we're at Collab Arts, C-O-L-A-B-A-R-T-S. Those are really the two best places to find us online.
And just finally, because this program will be online long after those events happen, so I want to leave the audience with a take-home message. I know that if I went to see Life, Death, Life Again, Children Sentenced to Die in Prison, that I may have to be someone whose viewpoint was changed. Do you find audience members having this as a transformation, as something that actually gives them a different perspective on the issues involved, whether that be radical forgiveness or sentencing, restorative justice, any of these concepts? Do you find that your audience members actually experienced a change of thought?
Well, as far as what that change actually is, anecdotally, absolutely. People find me after the performance and they thank me. And the two things I usually hear about are, I am so glad to see arts being used in a social justice capacity in this way in my community, or I did not know any of this. How can I get involved? And we've been tracking all of these responses with surveys that we designed through support from New Jersey Council for the Humanities, and just trying to continue to grow our coalition of people that want to be involved. As far as changing minds or changing transformative experiences, absolutely. People are coming to our performance completely unaware of the stories of these individuals and understanding that we are all vulnerable, and that really it's the conditions in which we come up that really dictate our actions. In a lot of respects, and makes it much more clear that whoever we put in prison for these kinds of crimes, particularly as juveniles, they're not bad people. They are not individuals that are doing these violent actions because they want to. It's coming out of a place of desperation. It's coming out of a place of a conditional input that, as long as we can keep that in mind, I really do believe that our country can move towards a place of restorative justice.
Dan Swern, co-founder and producing director of CoLab Arts. You're listening to Humanities Connection, a production of WFDU-FM and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. I'm Bob Mann. This program is broadcast on 89.1 FM, and then it's archived at www.njhumanities.org. And you can go to that website to find out about all of the interesting things which are done by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, as well as hearing archives of Humanities Connection. If I were to say Trenton, New Jersey, what would come to your mind? Well, of course, it's the capital of the state of New Jersey. But beyond that, you may know very little, and what you may know or think you know is based on misconception. We're going to be talking about Trenton during this segment of Humanities Connection, and my guest is Julia Taylor. She's Director of Community Planning and Development for an organization called IELS, but we're talking about a program which is being developed right now. As a matter of fact, it received what is called an incubation grant from the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, and the program being developed is called Touring Trenton. Julia is our guest right now, and she's speaking from the Trenton area with us here at our WFDU studios via the phone. Julia, thanks a lot for taking the time out.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's first of all talk about Trenton. I mentioned that anybody knows it's the state capital. You wouldn't even, you know, dare watch Jeopardy without knowing that. But beyond that, what are some of the misconceptions that people have about that city?
Well, I think, unfortunately, negative news stories have been pervasive about the city over the past several years and perhaps decades. And so people tend to think about the historic sites. They may know that the old barracks is here, for instance, but then they may think about crime, or they may be afraid to come to the city. And the good news is that those are misperceptions. It is a city full of life, a city full of arts and culture and history and wonderful architecture. And right now, this moment in time, there are several really transformative projects going on in terms of planning, in terms of redevelopment, in terms of people coming together across the city to make positive change. And that is sort of the inspiration for us to do Touring Trenton now. We want to find ways to bring people into the city.
So what is Touring Trenton? And I realize that you're only in a development phase as we do this initial broadcast in September of 2018, but what are some of the hopes and the visions? What would Touring Trenton actually be?
Our hope is to generate a series of tours that can be traditional on-the-ground tours. They may also be web-based or app-based tours that people can take on the ground or from the comfort of their own homes. And we want to highlight certain things that are inherent in the city or are going on now as a way to build interest, essentially. And there are three main topics that we're looking at. One is the history and lasting effects of the 1960s race riots in the city, which many people have this idea that that was the beginning of the end for downtown. So we wanted to, in that, you know, to use that as a lens to explore, well, was that really the case? And what's happening now in downtown? Is this sort of the phoenix rising from the ashes moment for downtown? I think that is an overblown way to look at it, but we've been lucky to partner with Purcell Carson and Allison Eisenberg, two academics from Princeton University who have been studying the riots in Trenton. And so we'll be working with them as they develop their content over time. They're working on both a book and a documentary. We want to complement what they're doing with an on-the-ground tour to talk about what was here, what actually happened during the riots, and what's happening now.
It's interesting, Julia, that you mentioned this as one of the three main focuses that you have, because the very first show we ever did here at WFDU for the New Jersey Council for the Humanities was back in 2010, and it was the filmmaking team, the Bongiornos, who did Revolution 67, and how important that was, and how much people may have misunderstood, and how it's being looked at from a different perspective these days. And so touring Trenton would also take that on.
Well, yeah, and you've just informed Touring Trenton, because I didn't know about that film, so we'll be sure to take a look at that.
Yeah, they're pretty good. As a matter of fact, they were phenomenal guests, and it really, it kind of shakes you up to take a look at it and to see what it means more than 50 years later. So, yeah, that's it's a great resource. So beyond, you know, the 60s and downtown, let me know about the other two.
Yeah, the other one we're looking at is a tour of what's called the Creek to Canal Creative District. And this is the city's first official arts and culture district. My organization, IELS, led a citywide planning process that culminated in 2016 with the plan for this district. It is focused in downtown, and its intention is to highlight all of the arts and culture activity that is already happening here, and there is quite a bit of it, but then also to think about how to use arts and culture as a springboard for community and economic development, how to attract more activity and more people to the city through the arts and culture lens. And so we will be developing a tour of the Creative District, what's here, what's coming, and from the humanities perspective, sort of how does arts and culture impact people's lives on a daily basis. And that's probably, of the three we're looking at, that's probably the one that we're going to focus on most intently right now, because it's happening as we speak. The riots, the 1967-68 riots tour will take a little longer because we need to make sure that we're acknowledging the timeline of our partners at Princeton.
What is number three? So you have the 1960s. And the disturbances of those days. You have the Creative District, which I didn't even know existed. And what's number three?
The third is a neighborhood just outside of downtown, touches up to downtown, where there's a lot of historic and cultural assets, specifically relating to African-American culture and history in the city. And so we're looking at that neighborhood that includes Shiloh Baptist Church, where Reverend Woodson, who was a legislator and major figure in the civil rights movement, he served there for decades. There's the Nixon School, which is a nationally registered historic site and was the first school for African American children in the city. There's also the Carver Center, which is formerly the Carver YMCA, which was a leading hub of African American culture in the city. Actually, we've heard many stories from residents about how the big bands used to pop into the Carver Center on their way between Philadelphia and New York shows. So we want to introduce people to all of these interesting things that happened, talk about how the neighborhood has changed, and talk about why, you know, it's a really important area to focus on. There's just so many resources in such a small area that it could really be a hub of activity and of remembering important cultural things that have happened, but then also spurring new things to happen.
You talked about walking tours. Who are some of the people who might do them? I don't mean specific personnel mm-hmm. decisions, but are you talking about having academics, local people, descendants of people who were there in 1967 or even much earlier? Who would be your hosts, your guides, for taking you around Trenton once this finally comes to fruition?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in terms of people who will take the tours, we hope that it's a broad range of people, and we think that with these three tours, there are enough points of interest that we could attract a broad range of people. They might say, I'm really interested in this particular facet of it, so let me take this tour, and then once we get them in the door, we can introduce them to other things they may care about. And in terms of who will give the tour, that's part of what we're researching right now, but we're really hoping to make sure that it is local people. We've got one of IELTS services is an alternative high school for students ages 16 to 24, almost all of whom have dropped out. So we were thinking of partnering with those students and setting them up on a job training program. They could be the docents for the tour, or residents in the particular neighborhoods could be the docents, or even some of the members of the arts and culture community. So this isn't really meant to be something that IELTS owns and operates moving forward. We just want to be the springboard for it and make it available to whoever thinks they can use it in their programming, their services, their communications with people.
And is this something where our listeners up here in North Jersey and New York City could even just go down for a weekend trip, a turnaround, not even stay overnight, and just have this as a day trip?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's our goal, is to set these up in a way that it's convenient for people to come to visit the city, take the tour, and then perhaps we develop incentives that go along with the tours, like deals at restaurants or deals at some of the historic sites. We really want to make it accessible to people, and that's also part of the reason why it won't just be a physical on-the-ground tour, because we do want to meet people where they are. If there are people who still have a little bit of trepidation about coming to the city, well, they can take these tours, you know, while looking at their computer, and maybe that will be enough to spark them to actually come physically to the city and take advantage of all of what we have to offer.
Yeah, and maybe the virtual tour will be enough to get people to actually want to come down on their own and do it in person, and that sounds great. What is the timeline you're talking about? This was an incubation grant. Obviously, if the audience is interested, they like the idea of what's down in Trenton, they're learning something new about it, and they want to go down. I know you need time to develop this, but what kind of timeline are we talking about?
Yeah, I think we'll be wrapping up this planning phase in the fall, and then we'd look to sort of bring it in-house, clean it up a little bit, and hopefully launch at least one of the tours in time for the warm weather next spring. So let's say somewhere in the April or May time frame. And if people are interested in following up on this, they can always check in with IELTS, and we'll make sure that this is available on our website, or people could just give us a call and ask what's happening.
We have less than a minute left in the segment, but we've been mentioning IELTS, and we really didn't tell the audience what it is. What is your organization?
IELTS is a 37-year-old nonprofit based here in Trenton. We work across the city, across the state, and try to influence thinking nationally about environmental and community development issues. We are focused on building self-reliant families in healthy, sustainable communities, which is a broad vision, but it gives us the latitude to do the work that's really necessary based on what we hear from residents and stakeholders on the ground.
What do you mean by self-reliant families?
Making sure that people have the skills and the tools and the resources to get wherever it is that they want to go.
And what also is, you gave me a nice, very quick summary of IELTS. Thank you very much. You're like a talk show host dream. Really quickly, what role did the New Jersey Council for the Humanities play in all of this with Touring Trenton?
Well, it's actually been excellent. We initially submitted an action grant, and through conversation with the grant staff, we decided it would be better to do the incubation grant first. They were critical in helping us sort of frame how we wanted to talk about this, how we wanted to frame the humanities aspect of it, and also making sure we had access to humanities scholars. So it's been really a wonderful partnership so far.
Julia, thank you very much. I wish you the best of luck with this. That is Julia Taylor. She is Director of Community Planning and Development for IELTS, talking about Touring Trenton. That's it for this episode of Humanities Connection. I'm Bob Mann. Thank you very much for listening. This program is initially broadcast on WFDU 89.1 FM, and then it's archived at www.njhumanities.org. You can go to that website not only to hear archives of our program, but to hear about all of the fascinating programs that are being run throughout the state by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities.